I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
Everybody, I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. Each week, we talk to the most interesting women in the world of food and bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life. Right now, I'm coming to you from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm here as part of our Future of Food tour. We've visited Atlanta, Nashville, Portland, Minneapolis, and Denver, and we'll be heading to Austin next month for the finale. In each city, we've talked to amazing chefs, bakers, farmers, activists, you name it, and we'll be bringing you the recordings later this summer on Radio Cherry Bomb. Thank you to everyone who's come to visit us on the tour. I've loved meeting all of you. Right now, I have a real treat for you, an interview with food radio legend Lynn Rosetto Casper. Lynn was the host of the Splendid Table radio program for 21 years and is a legend in the food world. She is one of the most distinctive voices in radio and has interviewed legends, including Julia Child and Nora Ephron. I hope you enjoy our conversation as much as I enjoyed interviewing Lynn. It was a real honor for me. First, thank you to our sponsors for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. If you are daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that has been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today. So Lynn, let's start at the very beginning. Where did you grow up?
I grew up about 15 miles outside of New York City, in what was then a new suburb, Paramus, New Jersey.
Famous for its mall.
This was before malls. Shows how far back it goes. But that's where I grew up, and New York was a bus ride away. And I was told by a great aunt at one point, when I was already well into my teens or my early 20s, that from the time she can remember, I wanted to move into New York City. And she said, even when you were a five-year-old, which was sort of surprising to us, but it was, it was a time when it was right after World War II, young people were moving out and the suburbs were being created. And it was a good childhood. It really was. And a phenomenal high school. The high school was the first high school in that area. We were the first class to go through 4 years. And it had attracted these crackerjack young teachers who were gifts of the gods. And you were marked not only, you've achieved so many points, but on your marks had color. If it was red, you were not working up to your capacity. And when you got a red A from a teacher, I mean, that was really challenging.
Wow, so you could do better.
You could do better because they knew. Teachers, I can remember one teacher we had who was new to the system, and he had gone back and read the history, the educational history of every one of us. We were 28 kids in the class. And he said, you know, now I have from kindergarten, at least the ones who were in town, from kindergarten to, what were we? We were juniors.
That's impressive.
Yeah, isn't it?
All right. So let's go from school to the kitchen. Who cooked at home?
My mother. And she was a very good cook. And my family is Italian on both sides. My father's family is Venetian and my mother's family is Tuscan. And the debates that took place in the kitchen. You know, this is a case, and I think this exists in every culture. It's just what the food is about. The argument, do you stir the polenta left to right or right to left? And these would be heated discussions, really heated discussions. But and our Italian food wasn't like the Italian food people were used to. Not a lot of tomato. Polenta, pasta was a treat. But my mother was also, I think, typical of first generation. She experimented with everything. She had had a German neighbor, and she made Rollarden, and she made,
Wait, I don't know what Rollarden is.
It's where you thin slice a piece of beef, and you pound it very thin, and then you put some ham and a dill pickle, and I don't remember what else, you know, maybe onion and garlic, and you roll it up, and you seal it with some toothpicks. You brown it in a sauté pan, and then you pour wine over it and broth and vegetables or whatever, and then you cook it. She made a fabulous sauerbraten. I mean, and these were the days she loved chow mein. Now, chow mein came out of a can, more or less. It was la choy, but it was the thing that they did at that time.
So when did you start cooking?
Well, I guess you could say I started cooking when I was probably 9 or 10. But really got into it after I was 15. My father died when I was 15, and my mother went to work, and she worked long hours. My grandmother lived with us, but my grandmother was never well. So I did these atrocious things. I mean, when I think back, I can see the attraction, but I loved beans, which I still love to today, but I would take whole wheat bread. I wasn't allowed to eat white bread. And I would toast it, and then I would cover it with mustard. I would pile drained canned, beans, and I'd mix relish in with that and chopped onion, and I'd put cheese over it, and I'd put it in the oven. And that was my big, big treat. I can't tell you how happy I was to eat that.
When's the last time you made that?
You know, now that you're mentioning it, it's been years. It might be fun to try it again.
We'll run your recipe for that. So, funnily enough, though, you weren't interested initially in a culinary career. You wanted to be an actress.
Yeah. And if I couldn't be an actress, I very much wanted to either direct or do. One of the things I loved was set and costume design. And we had a setup in high school that was pretty remarkable. Our stage, the high school auditorium, all the lighting, the board, so to speak, and sound was designed by an NBC set designer. Or electrician, whatever. And we had a very active theater program. And the standards were professional. You know, it wasn't, oh, we're kids doing a play and it's okay if you fluff your lines. And I got deeply involved in that from, gosh, early on. And I loved it. And it was the kind of thing that teachers would use. For instance, our senior play, this came out of English, not out of speech. Because normally the plays came out of the speech department, that the teacher who had looked at all of our histories and he had taken each one of us and we had an assignment. This was the equivalent of your PhD for the end of the year. We could choose a period in English literature or in England and we had to portray it. We had to talk about the science of the period. We had to illustrate it in some way that was visual and was verbal, the politics, the arts. We didn't get into the food. In those days, nobody was interested. And we had to do it single-handedly. And I decided that I would take the broad view and I was going to go from Everyman, which was the very beginning of literature in England, or part of the beginning of literature in England, to today. And he strongly suggested that I may want to wait for college. But I can remember in my little room, I had literally stacks that were feet high of books I had taken out of the library, and the challenge of it. And you'd go into a cold sweat because everything had to be presented on stage. His thing was that literature and theater are inseparable, and we should learn to express in many different ways. So this was the kind of thing. And then out of that, too, was we did A Midsummer Night's Dream. And what he constantly did, he challenged us because he had a bunch of kids who were pretty bright. And his point was, very few people have ever pushed you guys. You get A's, you know, especially in English. So he assigned me, first of all, I had the largest line part and I didn't have a good memory. Secondly, I had to do the set and costume design. And I made some of the costumes. It was hysterical. And, well, it wasn't hysterical. It was really a challenge. I can remember, we all worked so hard, and it was really exciting. It was a real challenge. And I can't say that in all the schooling I've had since then, I had quite the personalized, demanding, and this was not only true of him, there were other teachers who really got to know us and knew exactly where the chinks were and worked those. So it was a very exciting time. It was probably in many ways, some of the best educational experiences I had.
That's remarkable for years. High school.
Yeah, it was a remarkable school. It really was.
So you loved it enough that you went on to study acting after high school.
Well, I went to college and I ended up coming home. We didn't have a lot of money. And I was taking courses, but I realized I really wanted to try see what would happen. And I started going to the Circle in the Square. At that time, they had a theater school. And the teacher we had was Michael Kahn. He's now directing, I can't remember, I think he's heading up one of the theater entities in D.C. But he was doing a play on Broadway. He was an established director. And it was really incredible training. But one of the other things that was pretty swell, we would periodically go to the theater with him. And he wanted us to see the work of a young actor who was doing off Broadway. So we all went with him to see P.S. 192 or 194. And it was a young black actor, and he was amazing. Well, when Michael had to take a couple of weeks off because his show was opening, this actor stepped in. And he was great because he was our age. And he was, you know, he was one of us, and yet he was so far ahead. And he was James Earl Jones.
Oh, wow.
And it was a time when my mother was deeply worried about how I would make a living. But for me, it was something I just loved. You know, it just spoke to my heart. And the food was coming along, too, but I wasn't thinking about a career in food. Theater looked so much more secure.
So I read that your first job in food was at a department store in Brooklyn. So were you doing acting and this job at the same time?
I was really unsure of myself, and I did some auditions. I didn't take rejection easily. I took it very personally. So I ended up with a friend starting an improvisational kids street theater in Brooklyn. We were living in Brooklyn.
I read that and I was like, that's so Brooklyn.
Oh my God, yeah. And you know, Brooklyn even then was just a very special place. And, you know, we would get permission to block off a street, and we would have improvised costumes, and we had a heck of a lot of fun doing wonderful satire. And then we started doing very serious improv for adults in a setting where if it rained, you were all right. Someone from the Second City had moved back home, and he started working with us, and that was very exciting. But I had started teaching Chinese cooking to friends. It's a long backstory, and never would I call myself a great expert, but it was at a time when Chinese restaurants were just exploding because the immigration laws had changed. And this was fresh, you know, these were people who were coming directly or through Taiwan. And I was working for an artist and collector. His wife was Chinese. I was her slave when she did special dinners. And then I started, a book came out that was a wonderful series, pictures, explanations, technique. And so
Is that the Time Life series?
Yes.
Yeah. I was going to ask you about Florence Lynn.
Yeah. Well, incredible. Mm-hmm. Just incredible. Julia Child worked on the French edition. I know they're out there. And now I think they probably look very simplistic. But at the time, nobody had done that kind of depth. Anyway, I fell in love with it. I just fell in love with it. And we would do banquets once a month, which we would research and whatever. And friends would say, could you teach us? And the great line was, you know, I have to read the book the night before. And someone said, yeah, but you know the book to read. So, and somebody had heard about it at Abraham and Strauss, which was the first store in the country to have someone, in quotes, teaching cooking who was not selling anything. They were in the middle of the housewares department. You had complete freedom in saying, I'm not using that. That doesn't work. I'm going to use this. And it was great fun. I was a total freelancer in terms of, so I took that on and it was the beginning. I hosted James Beard and Andre Soltner, a wonderful restaurant that's gone now, but Lutèce and so many other people, Jacques Pepin. Oh, and in those days he was a stud muffin, just glorious man. And I was constantly learning. And at the same time I was going to school, it was a state school or a city school, but it had just won some awards from France as a culinary expertise. And so I took a baking course there, which was, 10 weeks and hands-on and learned so much. And so wherever I could, I would work with a chef. I learned from my butcher how to cut meat, you know, wherever you could. And then I would go abroad whenever I had saved enough money. So
I kind of see now sort of acting plus cooking. So when you're doing demos and teaching,
it was something I was comfortable with. Yeah.
There's sort of a theatrical element to the best teachers.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's fast forward to your first cookbook, The Splendid Table, recipes from Emilia Romagna, the heartland of Northern Italian food. Why did you decide to focus on that region?
It's a long story. I'll make short. We were living in Brussels. I was writing for Cuisine magazine, which had a short life, but a brilliant one. Talk about an iconoclast. It was quite a magazine. And I had studied with Marcella Hazan a couple of years before in Bologna.
That's amazing. That could be a whole episode.
Yeah, exactly. And the editor of Cuisine, I used to do a lot of writing for Bon Appetit. And the new editor of Cuisine was the former editor of Bon Appetit. And she said, we want to send you to Emilia Romagna, and we want you to do a major article on it. So I thought, oh, God, this is going to be wonderful. So the requirement was I have to have access, and I had a list. I needed historians. I needed anthropologists. I needed artisans. I needed people who understood. I had to piece together this puzzle because the big question, and this was the unspoken question of The Splendid Table, was why this food in this place? This is the only place you can make Parmigiano Reggiano. It is the only place you can make prosciutto di Parma. And it is the only place you can make the real balsamic vinegar. And it is famous throughout Italy for its hand-rolled egg pasta. No machine. Machines were, I quote, what the Tuscans used. And it was fascinating to me. Because food changes so much in old cultures from one place to another. And it ended up being a 10-year love affair. I kept going back again and again. And I found people, I learned. And I, you know, it was like following a yellow brick road. And then there were all these crossroads. And then someone would say, wait a minute, you have to meet so-and-so who's in a village of four people on the top of a mountain. And the road washes out periodically, but it didn't matter. So it was an incredible adventure. And when I ended up, I had a lot of scholarly work. I spent a lot of time in archives with old cookbooks. And I wanted to piece together how a cuisine evolves. And I decided to narrow it down from Christ to the present to 500 years. It begins in the Renaissance, which was really the beginning of the structure of modern cuisine. And there's so much rich material. And it ends up today. And it's a book of a lot of stories. And I had never seen a book done quite that way. Because with the material I had found, I could say on January 20th at night, there were 200 candles burning in the a place where you can go right now, the castle in Ferrara, which is now a museum, and the Duke at that time, who was so-and-so, and here was the political background, was hosting a banquet in honor of his uncle, who was the Duke of so-and-so. But one of the backstories here was that this was Ferrara, which sat on the Po River Delta, which was like the Mississippi Delta. Imagine if you commanded all of that. All the trade had to pass through. And the Venetians, because Veneto was on the other side of the river, were always trying to take over. And Ferrara was famous for playing both ends against the middle, because at their back were the city-states of Rome. And the Roman, you know, the Pope wanted. So it's all of this. And I became so fascinated. So the book was filled with stories. And I was told it would sell 5,000 copies. Well, that was 1992. It's still in print. I'm very proud.
Now, tell me how you went about getting a cookbook deal back then.
Well, that was when, I mean, we had a professional organization which was pure gold. It still exists. It's called something, but it's the International Association of Culinary Professionals. And you talk to your colleagues. And the other thing you do is you look at books you really love, books that you want your book to resemble, and you look at who edits it. And I had a short list of editors, but first I had to find an agent, and I had a short list of agents. And I sent the proposal, which was so rough. Oh, my God, it was rough. You know, it was like wrestling elephants under a blanket to write a proposal like this. And I got a call 2 days later from Jane Distel, and she's still my agent. And she was a crackerjack, and she still is. And I had heard about Maria Guarnaschelli, who at that time was with Moreau. And I had seen her name on books I so admired, people who I just, you know, thought were brilliant. And it ended up, I teamed up with Maria.
That's amazing. She's such a significant editor. I feel like you know so much about Judith Jones and maybe don't hear so much about Maria, but she still made major contributions.
She did, and she drove you. I mean, you went through periods where you hated her guts. And by God, you'd work with her again because—and I did on another book. She— the insight, the astute quality she had. And like Judith, she'd cook your recipes. You know, and this doesn't make sense. You're not explaining this. Think I'm at your shoulder. Talk to me. You know, that kind of thing.
So you went on to win multiple awards. As you mentioned, the book's still in print.
Yes.
So how did this book about Northern Italian cuisine become the basis for this radio show?
Well, a lady who was just here, Sally Swift, called me one day. I had been on NPR talking about the book, and she had said, have you ever thought of doing a radio show? And I'll make this a short story. I've been approached by a lot of people to do TV, and the theme seemed to be, you raise the money and we'll spend it for you. And also it was, well, you've got to do recipes. I wanted to do recipes, but the book was about food in all of its dimensions, or many of them. And that's the kind of show I wanted to do. Sally had been cooking from that book for months, and she got it. She had the same image. So Sally and her husband at the time, who had been head of national programming for Minnesota Public Radio, brought the idea to Minnesota Public Radio. And this is where public radio is so extraordinary. We were doing something that was almost impossible to explain. Everybody thought it was going to be a recipe show. Well, yes, but it's going to be much more. It's going to be humor, satire, you know, politics, etc. And they backed us. And they backed us until we got our footing. And now, 22 years later, the show is still going.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break, hear from our sponsors, and we will be right back with Lynn Rosetto Casper. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme, and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. It's time for our Bob's Red Mill Minute. With so many recipes at our fingertips, it's nice to find one that we love and revisit often. One recipe I make all the time, and especially in the summer, is the coconut key lime tarts from Gwyneth Paltrow's It's All Easy cookbook. It's vegan and gluten-free and really delicious. It tastes so much like a key lime pie, you'll be shocked. I use 2 Bob's Red Mill ingredients for this recipe. First, organic coconut sugar, which is growing in popularity as an alternative sweetener. I'm sure a lot of you have used it already. It's made from the nectar of coconut palm tree blossoms, who knew, and has a mellow caramel flavor and is used in the filling. The second ingredient is Bob's Red Mill almond flour, which is made from almonds that have been blanched to remove the skins, then ground to a fine texture. You use this in the crust. And the recipe calls for actual key limes, but I've made it with regular limes, and it turns out fine. You can find this recipe online, or you can find it in issue number 7 of Cherry Bomb magazine. And don't forget, with Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you are getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today. We're back with Lynn Rosetto Casper. We're so thrilled to be here talking to you, Lynn, by the
way. Thank you.
I mean,
thank you.
This is such a thrill for me. You have no idea, or maybe you do.
No, you make it a pleasure.
All right. So we were talking about how Splendid Table went from being this book about, this amazing book about Northern Italian cuisine, to this incredible radio show. So what was the show like in the beginning? It wasn't what it is today.
No, we wanted it to be what it is today, but we knew we had to move slowly. And also we had to get our footing. And I mean, I had been interviewed, I don't know how many times, but being the interviewer, you know, when you're writing, when you're a journalist, and especially when I was working in Italy, you want to gain people's confidence. You want them to talk freely. And I found out very quickly, making notes only distracted them and me. So I would put the tape recorder in the middle of the table, ask permission, and people would forget about it. And you'd talk for an hour. Well, you can't do that on air. I mean, you can, but you want to trim. And it essentially started out, first of all, we had one guest each hour, one subject. And, I think I did a bit called Kitchen Chronicles, where it was talking about, you know, well, the potatoes are in season. Here's, you know, 16 things you can do with a potato, and here's what you have to know about a potato, et cetera. But we would have one guest, and in the very beginning, the call-ins, because nobody knew we were here, were from our friends who had different names and different voices. And the first time that we got a real caller, I wouldn't let him off the air. Tell me about the family. You know, oh, what are you doing today? You know, that guy was so overwhelmed, delighted. But gradually we realized that if the subject didn't grab you, well, we lost you for an hour. Gradually went to segments. Gradually the variety built. We worked with people from all kinds of backgrounds. I love the scientists because a scientist who's also a teacher, fascinating person to talk to. But, you know, the geeky stuff, the satirical stuff. So it gradually evolved. And the audience evolved, I think, with us.
Who were some of your favorite guests?
Anthony Bourdain was one of them. Amy Sedaris.
Oh, go back to Anthony for a second. Why was he one of your favorites? You interviewed him very early on, if I remember correctly.
We were the first people, supposedly, I think, to interview him on air after he wrote that first article.
For The New Yorker?
For The New Yorker, yeah. Don't eat until you've read this. And I think that was the actual title. And we thought it was, you know, he was exposing what was real in a kitchen. And both Sally and I had spent a fair amount of time in restaurant kitchens. And, you know, that's part of it. And I always loved him. This came much later. And it's very pertinent now when he mentioned that if all the Mexicans who work in the restaurant business were to walk out, there would be nothing in your high-end restaurants and all your other restaurants. This, well, don't get me, I'm sorry, the political situation is just so disturbing. But at any rate, we kept trying things. Some things work, some things don't work. But one of the things that was important to us was scholarship. Scholarship that didn't necessarily show. Not the scholarship where you have someone talking down to an audience. But there were so many gifted people. There are so many gifted people out there who are doing fascinating work. And whether they be scientists or they be historians or anthropologists, and they had fabulous stories to tell. And the other thing that was interesting, too, was how you can use a radio show in very subtle ways to deal with a situation. And this was goes back perhaps 5 or 6 years ago. But when the Middle East was, as usual, a potboiler, but there was a lot of bad feeling, not to the extent of today, but there was a lot of bad feeling. And we started focusing a little bit more on the works of Middle Eastern authors. And one of the books that was really fascinating was, it was written by a Turkish journalist, and it was essentially the reprint of a 16th century manuscript about the Sufis. These are the whirling dervishes. And there is one city, I can't recall the name of it now, in Turkey, where that sect is centered. And it was, first of all, the food was fascinating. And the other thing was that the person who had written it could make it come alive. So, you know, you don't hit people over the head, but you kind of say, you lay out a little, here's a little spread for you to look at, and you may notice X.
So a subversive way to touch on politics and
yeah, and then sometimes
issues.
We honestly touched on. I mean, when Foreign Affairs did its first food issue, and it was during the Arab Spring, and they had a series of essays that were so well done, and we had the editor on talking about, and one of the things she talked about was, and this is nothing new, but that when you were victorious over your enemies, you fed them. You know, especially the poor people, you fed them. And that is a huge step toward gaining power.
Wow.
Yeah. And of course, you know, part of that whole rebellion came out of bread. And I don't remember if it was one of the first times that there had been some sort of tax or tariff on wheat to the point where people could not afford bread. And that was a broken trust between governments and the people. Bread was always supposed to be accessible. Maybe not meat, maybe not other things, but bread.
And now we've got food deserts and things of that sort.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so impossible today to separate food from politics.
And think about 10, 15 years ago. We never saw the relationship. Mm-hmm. It always bothered me, and I understand the pressures that create this, but that the food page, the business page, had information that should have been on the food page because it's all of, you know, it's the same yarn that's falling this ball. It's just different colors of it. Yeah, and now, God, you can't separate food and politics, which I think is great. And I think it's people are thinking in a different way. They may not be active. They may not be, you know, expressing opinions every moment, but they're aware. And the other thing is we're aware of who's working in the field, and we're aware of transport, and we're aware of the principles of the people who oversee all of that. And it goes on and on.
Feels a little overwhelming right now, though, because I think people who care in this industry want so much to make a difference. And it's where do you even begin these days? That's
Why
it was so incredible. Lynn and I were at a Cherry Bomb event last night where Pakku Hang spoke, and she is the executive director of Among Farmers Association.
Yes.
Here in Minneapolis. And when you hear the work that someone like she's doing to protect the farmers and care for the farmers, I mean, it's just remarkable.
It's a whole issue of we want our food to be grown in a responsible way, and we want farmers to be treated fairly. And the problem always is money. You know, but we have this large Hmong population, which over the years, from when I moved here in 1985, I saw how the traditional farmers in the market and then these new farmers who would rent land, essentially, first time I'd ever seen anyone get three crops out of a pea plant. We had never seen pea tops 30 years ago. They would take the pea tops and then there would be, and the peas, and there would be a second blooming.
Oh, so pea shoots you're talking about, which are so popular right now.
Yes, mm-hmm. And they, but we were seeing them a long time ago. And it was, again, all this hand work. And frankly, I mean, people will rail at me, but there should be more money spent. There should be more expensive.
I think a lot of people agree with you.
Yeah, and yet that comes back to the old problem of 5% of the population can afford that choice. And we've got all these people who really need that nutrition, need those choices. And
Well, change is in the air.
That's true. Absolutely.
News. And you are one of the people who pushed us in this direction. So thank you for that. I want you to tell us a little bit more about some of your favorite guests. You started to mention Amy Sedaris.
Amy Sedaris at one point was so funny. She was talking to a caller.
Oh, no,
and the two of them were so hysterical. I literally put my head down on the desk and just laughed. And her irreverence, at one point, her first book was, I think, Entertaining, I Like You, you know, something like that. And I was asking her about how she does a party. And she said, well, the first thing you do is you load up the medicine cabinet with marbles. And she said, the other thing I like to do is right by the door, I set up a table and on it, I have all the things I want to get rid of. And when people leave, I charge them. They can buy these things. And the other line, which I hope this doesn't offend people, but, you know, she said, and you know, the other thing is you don't want guests arriving early because, you know, maybe your drugs haven't kicked in, you know, whatever. And then her recipes, well, cheese balls. She brought back the cheese ball and cheese balls are pretty good. So, She is an observer, a satirist. She's just wonderful. And the laughter is amazing. This was one of the very early, I refer to this a lot. Sally rolls her eyes back every time I talk about it. But very early on in the show, we came across, in fact, Sally, I think, came across a little book called Foam, From Cappuccino to the Cosmos. And it was written by a physicist at Emory University. And he wrote this book essentially for the layman. And he had been making cappuccino in the morning. And he looked down and he said, you know, we've not done a great deal about foam. So he wrote this book. And it was fascinating. I brought him on. And he was an example of a scientist who's a great teacher, great storyteller. And he literally took us from looking down into a cup of cappuccino with all those that foam to the cosmos, because the structure is the same. And we talked about plastic, styrofoam. We talked about the ocean. The foam on the waves magnifies the light and how deep it goes. So if you have still water, the light will not go as deep into the water as if there's foam. And it goes on and on and on. I was just completely bewitched. And it was a great example of how an esoteric subject can become intriguing.
Which guest did you have on the most?
Well, Tony was on a lot. Mario Batali was on a lot. We had Jane and Michael Stern were regulars every single week. And one of the things, because they were dynamite, but the other thing is when you call a show The Splendid Table, people think you're going to be talking about a lot of hoo-ha restaurants and that's it, which has nothing to do with a lot of our lives. And Jane and Michael were the ones who were talking about the other side, the real world of food. And we love them. And I I can't specifically pin down right now, but they were a riot.
And for people who don't know them, they traveled the U.S. going to all the diners and roadside food places.
And this was in the 70s. They were they were both graduate students. And they decided, they didn't have any idea of how large the country was, but they were going to go out and taste all the road food. And they wrote a book called Road Food. There's been several editions. They have a fabulous website. And they were looking at the mom and pop restaurants and the chicken shacks and the fry places. And it was great because they found all these great places. And, we would travel across the country with their book.
It was before the internet, it was the Bible.
Absolutely. And now they have the road food website is dynamite. So they were great favorites. And one of the other favorites was, and he was a regular, Josh Wesson, who was a wine expert with a delicious sense of humor and a fabulous skill with satirical language. And one of the first things, we were talking about pairing wines, and at the end of the thing, I just threw it out to him. I said, okay, what do you drink with a Twinkie? And without missing a beat, he said, Asti Spumanti.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah, exactly.
So after 21 years of taking so many calls from home cooks, what did you learn about them?
I learned that we are very curious people. My goal was to get rid of the intimidation because if you trust yourself, for instance, how is basil and tarragon going to taste together? Should I use them? Take a little basil, take a little tarragon, put it on your tongue. You're going to know right away. I learned that people are deeply curious, and there are very few barriers. You'll be eating a very complex dish in a Chinese restaurant, and you'll call and say, how do I make it? And you may have not walked up to a stove in a long time, but you want to know. So that's where you begin. And I also found that people were so willing to tell their stories. They were fun. You know, once we were role playing together, and that was the great thing. People were open. And our Thanksgiving show every year, hilarious, wonderful, good sports. And also, some people who were in real trouble that we could help.
Now, how did your culinary taste change over those 21 years?
My basic training was in classical French cuisine because they defined the Western processes best, I felt. And then I felt after that I could cook almost anything. Italian, French, Chinese. But I think I've spread out much further. I will cook almost anything from almost any country and try it. I started to learn about chilies when we moved to Denver in 1976. And I've become fascinated by them. And I really do enjoy spicy food. But I'm finding my head turns more and more. Let's put it this way. When there's genius in the kitchen and you're going to serve me something that is a layer of a special gel that's been mixed with chocolate that will allow a piece of chocolate to be suspended from the ceiling, and there's this fabulous foam in there, but it's delicious. It just sweeps me away. I love it. But generally, there's so much food that's overworked. There's so much food that you don't remember 2 days later. And I like the food that people cook for their own kind when they're good at it. But I just think it's broadened. I think that's really the basis of it.
So, Lynn, why did you decide to retire?
Well, because there were a lot of things that you leave behind when you really fall in love with something. And I wanted, while I still had time, to bump around in them. I wanted to be able to have the freedom of doing what I want each day, spend time with friends. And the big reason was my husband was ill and he was doing well, but we both agreed, the last thing you want to do is be in a position of saying, why did I work until the end? And he passed away in 2015, and I had started pulling away from the show big time in 2013, very gradually, and had the backing. The crew is amazing, really. And I've never regretted it. So now I'm sort of learning a new life, and it's fascinating.
And what have you been doing?
I've been making art. A term I had never used until recently.
Making what kind of art?
I love to do mixed media, you know, putting things together. I used to draw constantly as a kid, and I'm drawing again. I collect all kinds of things to do. I mean, there's no excuse for the amount of bits and pieces I've collected to, I imagine, all these collages. I'm starting to cook again. I'm new friends and old friends, and I really have time for them. You know, you know what it's like. You're working, and you meet people at a party or whatever, and you say, gee, I'd love to get to know them better. And, you know, 2 months later, you've been working, and you have a family, and there's just isn't time. Well, now there's more time. And I'm exploring. Something intrigues me. I want to read a book all day. I read a book all day. And I'm finally catching up on my reading on things that are not necessarily food. So
everyone will want to know what you're cooking now that you have time to really cook.
Well, in one sense, I'm learning about what it is to live alone. And I'm learning what it's like to cook for one. And sometimes I don't want to cook. But what I've been doing lately, well, you know, I'll give you an instance. Grilled asparagus that I've grilled, but I've got onion rings tossed in with them. And I just spread them over a plate. And then I take a little scoop of burrata. And that's my dinner.
Mm.
And it's just wonderful. I love beans, and I've been fooling around with, I've always collected beans. There's a bean collection that has crossed the ocean twice, I have to tell you. I find
How
a bean.
How does one collect beans?
Dried beans. They hold up. They really do. Some of them have been found in Egyptian tombs. I cook them and I try them. The other thing is I've always loved chilies. I just discovered a chili I'd never seen. We have a large Mexican population here, which is such a blessing. And we have great stores. It's a fresh chili. And I think it's called a manzano, but it's also called the apple chili. And it's yellow, and it looks like an apple, smaller, but and it can be hot. But, oh, my God, it's so fruity. And you mix that with a little bit of lime, a little bit of coriander, and I threw in mint, and just let it sit. And it's fabulous. So this morning I had yogurt and blueberries, and I put some of the yogurt aside, and I just topped it with the salsa.
I feel like I'm hearing the show again. It's making me nostalgic, hearing you talk about all those wonderful ingredients. All right, you are the mama of all these food podcasts. What do you think of the big boom in podcasting?
I think it's wonderful. Storytelling. This is the kind of thing that, how many thousands of years? That storytelling was how people learned, you know, how they learned what was going on in the next village, how they passed on traditions. I think they're fabulous. Yeah, there's a million of them, and everybody does them. Some of them are wonderful. Some of them maybe not so much. It's great. I think it's fabulous. We've got this open-ended ability to communicate now and to try things. So I'm sold, absolutely sold.
So my last question for you is, back when you did your cookbook, you called it The Splendid Table. What did The Splendid Table mean to you back then? And over the 21 years of doing the show, what has The Splendid Table come to mean?
Well, the title for the book was very tricky because no one knew what Emilia Romagna was. So it couldn't be the food of Emilia Romagna. And I had I think in pictures often. And my editor had said, every time you get an idea for a title, just put it, you know, add it to the computer. And I kept thinking of this tapestry of the region visually and all of the people and the historical figures and the modern ones and all of the foods. And I have this thing about how, especially food, it's about layers. And there's a term used in art called pentimento. Have you heard it? Where you remove a layer and by God, there's something behind it and something behind it. So my tapestry is not only overlapping images, but underneath it, it's layers of images. And I just thought The Splendid Table best described it. And originally, it was a tough title for the show because, excuse me, it sounded as though we were going to be doing very...
It sounds grand.
Yeah. But I've loved it, and it's worked. And
so what does the Splendid Table mean today?
I think the Splendid Table means today what the show is. It's about the table in the broadest sense of the word. You know, at the Cherry Bomb meeting last night, when we were talking about families around a table, a very long time ago, a dear friend lost her husband, and they were very close friends with an Episcopal minister, a very remarkable man. And all of us gathered in the church, most of us not necessarily members of the religion. And he did a sermon that was so wonderful. He said, "Do you know what the altar represents?" He said, "It's the end of a table." And he said, "And in many countries, you define family by who is sitting at your table." Which was pretty, and he said, "You've come here, whether you are part of the faith or not, you know, whatever you believe, we've all come together as family to be with our friend." And the other thing about the table is, if you think about it, if you can put away the cell phones, it's the only few chances we get to look each other in the eye. And that's the thing that I've never forgotten. So that's the Splendid Table.
Well, by that measure, you have a huge family.
We all have a huge family.
Absolutely. Well, Lynn, thank you so much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for everything you've done for the food world and for women. And you're such an inspiration and a treasure.
I'm blushing, and thank you, Carrie. This is an honor.
That's it for today's show. Thank you to the one and only Lynn Rosetto Casper and to the team at Minnesota Public Radio for helping us with this episode. Thank you to our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill, the best friend of every baker we know, and to Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. You can subscribe to our show wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can subscribe to Cherry Bomb Magazine at cherrybomb.com. Our theme song is by the band Tra La La. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.